Ezekiel 23 consists of a parable in which, in very explicit language, the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah are presented as God's unfaithful wives. The chapter bears many similarities throughout with chapter 16, where the people of Jerusalem, that is Judah, were presented as God's unfaithful bride, but the emphasis is different. There, the main problem being highlighted by the prophet was the unfaithfulness of Judah in turning aside to idols. Here, it is the unfaithfulness of God's people in making political alliances, though, as we shall see, the two were closely interrelated. Aholah and Aholibah were sisters who are presented as being married to Yahweh. Aholah represents the northern kingdom of Israel, or Ephraim, with its capital city of Samaria. She is the elder, or more correctly, greater, for she has 10 tribes. Aholibah represents the kingdom of Judah, with its capital city of Jerusalem. And the same figure of God being married to these two women is used in Jeremiah 3, which should be compared with this chapter. The conception of God being married to his people is one that we examined in some detail in the consideration of Ezekiel 16. Sons and daughters were born to God by both women kingdoms. For example, even in the sinful northern kingdom, in the time of Elijah, there were 7,000 who had not bowed the knee to Baal. They were God's children. At the time this prophecy was given, there were still some faithful men, such as Ezekiel and Jeremiah in Judah. These two were God's children. These two women are expressly stated to be the daughters of one mother. And from chapter 16, we've already learned concerning Judah that her mother was a Hittite, indicating that the life of the people of Judah was essentially Canaanitish. They demonstrated these Canaanitish ways from their national youth. They committed whoredoms in Egypt. Chapter 20 pointed out that all Israel had been seduced by Egyptian idolatry. Although when in Egypt they sighed by reason of the bondage, their miraculous deliverance by Yahweh did not cure the nation's longing for things Egyptian. In the making of the golden calf, a representation of the Egyptian deity Apis, their subsequent rebellion and longing for the things of Egypt, and an expressed desire to return to Egypt when God was putting them to the test to prove them, to know what was in their heart, all show that this was so. But given the opportunity, they would have gone back again to that pagan nation, because their desire for Egypt and its gods was greater than their desire for Yahweh, their God. The names, as always in Hebrew, have meanings. Aholah means her own tent, and Aholibah, my tent is in her. And no doubt the names refer to the forms of worship carried out in each kingdom. Regarding Judah or Aholibah, in chapter 16 we read, thy mother was a Hittite, at verse 20 in the RV. And there could well be in these names a reference to Holibama, which means my tent is a high place. Esau's Canaanitish wife, thus emphasizing the apostasy of Israel. In the northern kingdom, there was the system established by Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, her own tent. Whereas in Judah was the place which God chose for his habitation, God's tent was in her. In the context of this chapter, another point is surely being made. These tents, representing the two forms of worship in Israel and Judah, are being compared with the tents set up for prostitution. For even the worship of Yahweh in Jerusalem, as seen later in this chapter, became the center of Judah's unfaithfulness. One point needs to be stressed. In this chapter, God is presented as marrying two wives who were sisters. To marry two sisters was contrary to the law. Thus, we cannot argue from what is a parabolic presentation of the situation that existed between God and his people and say, because God in the parable presents himself as doing this, therefore his people are permitted to do the same thing. Whereas we had seen, it was expressly forbidden by the law. Even though from the beginning of the northern kingdom of Israel, which following Jeroboam, established her own priesthood and system of worship, and subsequently in the time of Ahab brought Baal to occupy the center of her religious life, yet God did not forsake her. He describes their kingdom as mine. And as the books of Kings show clearly, God, by sending his prophets, sought to show this people the error of their ways. But she played the harlot. And the harlotry referred to in this chapter is that of forming political alliances with fleshly nations. It is the attitude which even in the time of Samuel said, make us a king to judge us like all the nations, thereby showing a lack of confidence in God's ability to rule. To seek help from Assyria, as the northern kingdom had done, was to say that they had no confidence in God's ability to save. Israel's Assyrian lover and her inordinate relationship with him is described in verses 5-7. Hosea refers to this folly of the northern kingdom in Chapter 8, for they are gone up to Assyria, a wild ass alone by himself. Ephraim hath hired lovers. Examples are to be found historically in 2 Kings 15, when Menahem formed an alliance with Puel, and 2 Kings 17, which speaks of the alliance made by Hoshea, who bought off Shalmaneser of Assyria and became his servant and gave him presents. However, Israel's relationship with Assyria had commenced much earlier than either of these events. Although there is no biblical record of it, the black obelisk of Shalmaneser III, which is in the British Museum, has a picture of Jehu kneeling before the Assyrian emperor, followed by Israelites bearing gifts. Political alliance often led to, or was preceded by, religious alliance. And so verse 7 says, with all their idols she defiled herself. It is interesting to note in this connection on the photograph of the black obelisk that in the picture of Jehu bowing to Shalmaneser, opposite the arrow, the Assyrian monarch is offering a libation to his gods, and incense is being offered by his companions. So Jehu was a party to this. Thus, further apostasy was added to the whoredoms brought from Egypt. That is, the worship of Apis, with whom Israel committed fornication in the desert, and which Jeroboam the son of Nebat introduced at the beginning of the northern kingdom. Well, the ten tribes never forsook this particular form of idolatry. And Jehu, at the time of his outlawing of Baal worship, allowed the worship of the calves to continue. 2 Kings 10. The judgment of the northern kingdom is parabolically described in verses 9 and 10. Israel was delivered into the hand of her lovers. In 722 BC, when Hoshea was dethroned and the ten tribes carried captive into Assyria. Aholibah, the southern kingdom, ruled over by Hezekiah at the time of Ahola's judgment, should have taken heed, mended her ways. Instead, she became more corrupt. Jeremiah likewise noted Judah's folly. This is in chapter 3 of Jeremiah. When backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also. Judah's lovers, as given by the prophet, are listed below, together with the historical events referred to. Assyria. The Assyrians are said to be neighbours of Judah. The word can mean one of three things: near a place, near of time, or near of personal relationship. Asher was the brother of Arphaxad, the latter being one of the ancestors of Abraham. The military organization of Assyria made Judah envious and led to a desire to rely on flesh rather than on the armies of the living God. And this resulted in such alliances as that made by Ahaz with Tiglath-Pileser in order to ward off the king of Syria. Babylon. The reference is no doubt to the friendship shown by Hezekiah to Merodach Baladan. The words of Ezekiel 23 indicate that the move to make the alliance was not one-sided. Judah rushed headlong into it, receiving in consequence the terrible prophecy of the future of Babylonian invasion. Egypt. In verse 19, the phrase "in calling to remembrance the days of her youth" should perhaps be understood in the sense of reliving or repeating the folly of her youth, and the reference to the frequent overtures made by Judah to Egypt. We have earlier referred to the oaths of allegiance made by Zedekiah to Egypt, which were to prove useless. Jehoiakim had also formed an association with Egypt, which did not protect him from Nebuchadnezzar. The punishment of Aholibah. As in the case of Ahola, the northern kingdom, so with Aholibah, Judah, her lovers were to be her judges. Sated with her inordinate passion, her heart became alienated from Babylon, firstly, when Jehoiakim rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, and later when Zedekiah likewise rebelled. And the invasion recorded in 2 Kings 24 was the result of the first of these alienations, and the final devastation of Judah in 2 Kings 25 was the result of the second. It is to this final invasion that Ezekiel refers. The armies of Babylon with those of her vassal states, Pekod, Shoah, Koah, which are Aramean tribes from the east of the river Tigris, and Assyria came against Judah in the reign of the wicked prince of Israel, Zedekiah, and utterly destroyed her kingdom. And it was a custom with the pagan invaders that wives who normally wore rings of gold in their noses and ears, if they were unfaithful, had their noses and ears mutilated in punishment. So Judah, the harlot nation, was to be cruelly treated. They shall take away thy nose and thine ears. Verse 25. There's a footnote regarding Pekod, which means retribution. It appears to be used by Jeremiah in his 50th chapter as a symbolic name for Babylon. It's possible that Pekod, together with Shoah, which means crying, and Koah, from a Hebrew root meaning to wound, are here used by Ezekiel both symbolically and literally. The combined Babylonian armies invading Judah would bring with them retribution, crying, and wounding. This disfigurement of the body politic of Judah was to be performed by the fire and the sword of the divinely appointed Babylonian judge, who was to judge thee according to their judgments, verse 24. That is the way in which they normally dealt with errant wives. The stripping of her clothes and the removing of her jewels may be a reference to the removal by Nebuchadnezzar of the precious things of the temple, which were the ornaments of God's bride nation. As a result of this final Babylonian invasion, thy lewdness and thy whoredom brought from the land of Egypt, verse 27, were to cease. The tendency towards idolatry manifested persistently from the time of the Exodus was to be eradicated. And it is a historical fact that following the Babylonian invasion and the subsequent restoration, Israel, although seduced by Gentile philosophy, never again turned aside to idols. Verse 30 is a section that clearly states the point we've already made, that political alliances were usually associated with religious apostasy. And this is demonstrated by reference to the black obelisk of Shalmaneser III. To separate the two, except for emphasis, is artificial. And the result of the judgment is that Judah became naked and bare, verse 29, which was her state when in the bondage of Egypt. And because of her loathsome unfaithfulness, the cup which God had given Samaria to drink was to be given to Jerusalem also. And the figure is a common one in Scripture. This cup is given by God and contains the judgments of the Almighty upon the nation that drinks it. Politically, that nation reels to and fro, is made naked and covered with vomit. Some even drink themselves to death and become as though they had not been. I'm quoting from Jeremiah 49, Isaiah 24, Habakkuk 2, and Obadiah. Of this cup, Samaria had sucked and ceased to exist. And Judah was about to drink the very dregs, verse 34. And the act of intoxicated madness referred to in verse 34, pluck off thine own breasts, may well refer to the way in which Gedaliah, who would have provided sustenance and strength to the tiny remnant left in the land, was killed by Ishmael after the Babylonian invasion. This final section recapitulates that which has already been set forth. This begins at verse 36, and it enlarges on some of the details. Only brief notes are necessary. The adultery of the two women was associated with idolatry of the grossest kind, even to the extent of offering their children in sacrifice to their gods. And this practice has previously been referred to by the prophet. On each occasion, the phrase calls to pass is used. In the Hebrew, this is one word, abar, meaning to pass, as well as several other nuances. The same word is found in Exodus 13, where Israel was commanded to set apart, Hebrew, abar, unto the Lord, all the firstborn, whether man or beast. The offering of the firstborn to pagan deities was a terrible transgression of this divine obligation. Verses 38 and 39, God's sanctuary in Judah was desecrated by their unfaithfulness, the people entering it on the same day in which they had participated in the offering of child sacrifices. God's Sabbaths, the sign of the covenant people, were thus profaned. Although in reverse order, in the same way their forebears in the wilderness offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, they sat down to eat and drink at Yahweh's table and then rose up to play before their idols. Thus, on that occasion too, God's feast was profaned. Like a harlot with painted eyes, a holy bar, Judah alone now appears to be the subject of the prophecy, reclines on her couch, sending messengers to bring in her clients from the mighty Babylonians who came with their treasures to the riffraff from the desert who assembled with their trinkets. With her on the very harlot's couch was Yahweh's incense and oil. They were there as mere forms of worship that were not in any way influencing her actions. A form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. Under the law, the adulteress was stoned, so in this final section, the punishment of this unfaithful people is presented under this figure. In verse 47, the judgment stones will be thrown by the Babylonian armies, but verse 45 says, the righteous men shall judge them after the manner of adulteresses. If this refers to the Babylonian armies, then it can only be in the sense that they, as opposed to Zedekiah, had right on their side, or that they were instruments through which God's righteousness would be displayed. More likely, the righteous men were the few faithful who sigh and that cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof. By their prayers they brought God's judgments upon the wicked nation. Footnote here. With this should be compared the similar situation in Israel in apostolic times. Concerning those days, in the parable of the unjust judge, the Lord said, shall not God avenge, which is from the Greek ektikeo, his own elect, which cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them? I tell you that he will avenge, from the Greek ektikeo, them speedily. This refers to the judgment of that unfaithful unfaithful nation by the Romans. And Jesus, referring to that judgment, said, "These be the days of vengeance, ecdikesis." Thus, the Roman judgment came as a result of the righteous men, God's own elect, crying day and night to him in prayer. And on this, see, J. Thomas, Last Days of Judah's Commonwealth, Herald of the Kingdom and Age to Come, Volume 9, page 149, and J. Aufrey, The Lord's Mount Olivet Prophecy, page 40. Verse 48, all women are to take heed of the fate of these two women. What powerful exhortation there is for those who have been called to be the bride of Christ in the record of the terrible unfaithfulness of God's people set out in this chapter. And let us take to heart the lessons that this prophecy contains, so that it will not be said of us, as it was said of some of our first century brethren, "Ye adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore would be a friend of the world maketh himself an enemy of God."